From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Man Who Didn't Believe in Ghosts by Nick Liothaus. In a town not far from Edinburgh, there was a house that was said to be haunted. It wasn't the sort of house you'd think would attract a ghost at all. It was only a two-story cottage with a garret, and it was far too neat and pretty for ghosts to care much about. The outside walls of it were painted white, and its casement windows had diamond-shaped panes to them. There was a climbing rose trained over the front door, and there was a flower garden before the house and a kitchen garden behind it, with a pear tree and an apple tree and a small green lawn. Who'd ever think that a ghost could choose to bide in a place like that? But folks did say it was haunted all the same. The house had belonged to an old attorney with only one child, a daughter. Folks old enough to remember her still say that there never was another lass as bonny as her in the town. The old man loved her dearly, but she died early. There was an old sad story told about her being in love with the son of an old laird who did not favor the match. The poor lad died of a fever while they were still courting, and not long after, she died too, folks said, of a broken heart. After that, the old man lived alone in the house, with a woman coming in each day to take care of it. There wasn't a word said about ghosts in the old man's time. He'd not have put up with it for a minute. When the old attorney died, there was nobody left that was kin to him but a second cousin several times removed. So, to keep the property in the family, the old man left all he had to the cousin, including the house, of course. The young man was grateful, but as he was not married, he had little use for a house. The lodgings he was living in suited him fine, so he put the renting of the house into an agent's hands. The rent money would make a nice little nest egg against the time when he decided he would like to get married. When that time came, he'd want the house for himself. It was the folks the agent found to live in the house that started all the talk about ghosts. At first, they were very well pleased with the house, but as time passed, they began to notice queer things were happening in it. Doors would open and close again, with nobody at all near them. When the young wife was dusting the spare bedroom, she heard drawers being pulled open and shut again behind her. But when she turned about to look, no one at all was there. Things were lifted and put down again before the tenant's very eyes, but they couldn't see who was lifting them or putting them down. They came to have the feeling that there was somebody always in the house with them. Of course, they tried to be sensible about it, but it gave them a terrible eerie feeling. As for getting a maid to stay, it couldn't be done. The maids all said that they felt that someone was always looking over their shoulders while they worked, and every time they set something down, it got itself moved to another place. They wouldn't take it upon themselves to say why, but they'd take whatever pay was coming to them and go, and they did. The end of the tenant's day in the house came upon the day when the young wife came into the sitting room to find her wee lad rolling his ball across the floor. Every time the ball reached the middle of the room, it seemed to turn and roll itself back to him, as if someone who couldn't be seen were playing with him. But when he looked up at his mother and laughed and said, "Bonnie lady," 'twas more than she could bear. She caught him up in her arms and ran out of the door to one of the neighbors, and no one could persuade her to set foot in the house again. So her husband went to the agent and told them they were sorry, but the way things were, they'd have to give up the house. The young man to whom the house had been left was a very matter-of-fact young fellow. He didn't believe in ghosts. He was quite put out because the story had got around that there were ghosts in the house. Of course, the young couple who had lived there couldn't be depended on not to talk about what had happened. It wouldn't have been according to human nature for them to get quiet about it. What made it awkward was that by this time, the young man had found the lass he wanted to marry. But unfortunately, she had heard the story. And she did believe in ghosts. She said that she loved him dearly and would like very much to marry him. But she told him flatly that she could never, never bring herself to live in a haunted house. Well, the doors did open and close of themselves, but that didn't daunt him. He just took them off their hinges and rehung them. They went on opening and closing just the same, but he said that was only because of a flaw in the walls. He had to admit to himself that he heard drawers opening and closing, and latches of cupboards clicking shut. There was a tinkling in the china closet, too, as if someone were moving the cups and plates about. And once or twice he thought he heard water running in the scullery. But when he looked, every tap was shut off tight. Besides, he knew there was no one but himself in the house. So he said that old houses were always full of queer noises because of the foundation settling, and paid them no more heed. Even when a book he had just closed and laid on the table opened itself again, and the leaves turned over slowly, as if someone were looking at them, he told himself that it was just a puff of wind from the window, although afterward he remembered that the windows were closed at the time. But still, he didn't believe in ghosts. So he went on living in the house and trying to persuade his sweetheart to marry him and come and live there with him. And of course, it convinced her that the house wasn't haunted at all. But he had no luck, for she wouldn't be persuaded. Well, things went on in this unsatisfactory way until his summer holidays came around. He decided now that he had the time for it to do something he'd been meaning to do and never got around to. There were a lot of clothes in the attic that had belonged to the old lawyer and his daughter. It seemed sinful to leave them there to molder away when some poor lady's body be glad to have them. So what he was going to do was to pack them up all and send them to the missionary society, where a good use would be found for them. He went up to the garret and found some empty boxes and began to pack the clothes. They were all hanging in several tall wardrobes ranged around the room. He packed the old lawyer's clothes first. There were a good many of them, suits and coats and boots and shoes, all of the best quality, to say nothing of a quantity of warm underclothing in boxes neatly stacked on the floor of the wardrobes. When he had taken everything out and folded it neatly, he packed the boxes and set them out of his way and turned to the wardrobe that held the dead lass's clothes. When he opened the first wardrobe, there was a sound, uncommonly like a sigh. It gave him a start for a moment, but then he laughed and told himself that it was only the silk of garments brushing against each other in the breeze made by the opening door. He began to take them out one by one, and to fold them and gently lay them in the box he'd set ready for them. It made him feel a little bit sad and sentimental to be handling the dresses that had been worn by the pretty young thing who had died so young and so long ago. He laid away five or six of them when he came to one frock that seemed strangely heavy for the material of which it was made. It was a light, crisp cotton sprigged with flowers, still bright in spite of the years it had hung in the wardrobe. He thought that a dress like that should have had almost no weight at all, so he looked it over curiously. Perhaps a brooch or a buckle was the answer. Then he found a pocket set in the seam of the skirt, and in the pocket a small red book and a letter. It was a letter of the old style, with no envelope and the dead girl's name and address on the outer folded sheet. He laid the dress aside, and taking his find to the low-set window, he sat down on the floor to read what he had found. He was not a man to read other people's letters and secrets, but something made him feel that it was the right thing to do now. He read the first letter. It said, "My dear love, although they have not told me, I know that I am very ill. It may be that we shall not meet again in this world. If I should die, I beg of you to make them promise that when you two are dead, we shall lie together side by side. Your true love. The young man sat for a while, thinking of the letter, wondering how it had come to the lass, remembering that he had heard that the old laird was dead set against the match. Then he took up the little red book and opened it. The little book was a sort of day-by-day diary, with a date printed at the top of each page. It had begun as a sort of housekeeping journal. There was a lot in it about household affairs. There were records of sewing done, of jars of pickles and jams laid by, and about the house being turned out and cleaned from end to end, and such things. But through it all was a story of a young girl's heart. She told about meeting the laird's son, where they first met and when he first spoke to her of love, and what they said and how they planned to marry as soon as the old laird could be persuaded to give his consent to the match. Although he was against it, they thought he might be brought over in time. But they had no time. Poor young things. Soon after, the diary told of the letter that John the carrier had brought her, that had frightened her terribly. And the next page said only, "My love is dead." Page after page was empty after that. Then toward the end of the little book she had written, "I know that I am going to die. I ask my father today to promise to beg the laird to let me lie beside my love when I am dead." But he only turned away and would not answer. "I am afraid his pride will not let him ask a favor of one who would not accept me into his family. But, oh my love, if he does not, I'll find a way to bring things right. I'll never rest until I do." And that was all. The young man raised his eyes from the page and repeated thoughtfully, "I'll never rest until I do." It was right then and there that he began to believe in ghosts. He put the diary and the letter into his pocket, and leaving everything just as it was in the garret, he went downstairs. The packing could wait for another day. He had something better to do. As he went, he thought of the old attorney living there day after day with the ghost of his dead daughter mutely beseeching him to do what his pride would never let him do. "Well, I have no pride at all," the young man said. He packed the bag and put on his hat and coat and started for the station. But as he went out the door, he turned and put his head back and called, "Do not fret yourself any longer, lass. You can rest now. I'll find a way to bring things right." At the station, he was fortunate enough to find a train that would take him where he wanted to go. When he got off the train, he asked about the village for news of the laird. Och, the old laird was long dead, folks told him, and a rare old curmudgeon that one was, though they shouldn't be saying it of the dead. But the new laird, him that was the old laird's nephew, had the estate now, and a finer man you'd not be finding should you search for a year and a day. So up to the castle the young man went. When he got there, he found the new laird as reasonable a man as he could hope to find. So he gave him the letter and the diary and let him read the story for himself. Then he told him about his house and the ghost in it that would not rest until she had her way. The old laird's nephew listened gravely, and at the end of the young man's story he sighed and said, 50 years, 50 long years. What a weary time to wait, poor lass." The old laird's nephew believed in ghosts himself. He called his solicitors at once and got them to work. They were so quick about it that by the time the young man got back home, after paying a visit to the old laird's nephew, who asked him to stay till all was settled, the two lovers were reunited at last and lay together side by side in the old laird's family tomb. When he got home, he could tell the minute he stepped through the door that there was no one there but himself. There was no more trouble with the doors, and the only sounds were the ordinary sounds that he made himself. He finally persuaded the lass he wanted to marry to come for supper one night and bring along the old aunt she lived with. The aunt prided herself on having such a keen scent for ghosts that she could actually smell one if it were in a house. So they came, and as soon as they were all settled at the supper table, the aunt looked all around the room and sniffed two or three times. Ghosts? "Nonsense, my dear," she said to the young man's last firmly. "There isn't a single ghost in this house. You may be sure I'd know at once if there were." That satisfied the young lady. So soon she and the young man were married. They lived together so happily in the house that folks completely forgot it had ever been said that it was haunted. It didn't look at all like the kind of a house that would ever have a ghost. Only the young man remembered. He really did believe in ghosts, after all. Dead Trouble by Aidan Chambers. The trouble with being dead is that no one believes you are alive. Things were different years ago, or so I'm told by others better able to know than myself. In earlier times, people still believed in God and the devil, and therefore, of course, in ghosts. But nowadays, all that has changed. Only last week, for instance, one of the oldest inhabitants in these parts made a chilling appearance at a party where the guests were playing on the Ouija board. But instead of being received with shocked horror, he was laughed at. Imagine it. The guests laughed and said he wasn't there at all, that they had all had too much to drink, which, along with the Ouija, had affected their imaginations, making them think they saw a ghost. My own experiences in the last few months, since I was forced to take up this way of life, have been pretty humiliating. But this treatment of an expert, senior ghost, a professional you might say, was a scandal. People here talked about it for days. The poor fellow himself was so upset he spent every night for weeks afterward lying around sulking invisibly. And I don't blame him. The whole business was dispiriting. But I'd better begin at the beginning. Otherwise, I'll never get to the purpose of this message. 3 months ago, I fell into the concrete mixer at work. The mixer was a huge affair. Not one of those little ones you see churning away on small building sites. We made bulk concrete in it, ready for transporting in large quantities by truck to major constructions. At any rate, I fell in. I blame myself, really. It was no one else's fault. I should have kept my mind on my work instead of thinking about Veronica. She was my girlfriend at the time and was being a bit troublesome. Before I go on, I must explain that death is quite different viewed from my present situation than it is viewed from yours. As with most things in life, or after it come to that, death does not seem half so bad when it is all over as you think it is going to be before it happens. Just like going to the dentist is worse to think about beforehand than it is when you get there, and is often quite a laugh afterward. Well, dying is just the same. We here are always laughing about it, especially when people have just arrived. It is such a relief to them, and they wonder what all the fuss was about. Like so many modern people, I used to think death meant the end of everything, kaput, the finish. Needless to say, I know differently now. Mind you, there have been times during the last few months when I have wished my death really had been the end. Death is like everything else in another way too. Some people die lucky, others don't. I didn't. Though up to my death I had been pretty fortunate, the episode with the concrete mixer seemed to change all that. I haven't had a stroke of luck since. Let me explain. When I slipped into the mixer, I was on my own. My mate Harry was having his tea break. I was keeping things going until he returned to relieve me. But when he got back, I had gone. He isn't particularly bright, isn't Harry, and he didn't think of looking in the mixer for me. He thought I'd gone off sick. At home, my family, father, mother, sister, started worrying when I didn't get in that night. But they waited until the following morning. Then they informed the police. After a bit of investigating, everyone decided I must have run off, and the police put me on the missing persons list. Meanwhile, of course, I had been churning around with a half-mixed concrete. I hadn't expected to fall in, so I escaped the awful business of knowing I was going to die, though as it turned out, it wasn't such an ordeal as you might suppose. For a start, it was over quickly. A slip of the foot, a nasty couple of minutes swilling about with the sand and gravel and cement and water, and I was dead. I didn't much care for the gravel. I've always had fairly sensitive skin. But the change of state from what I was to what I am now happened in the blink of an eye, and was really rather a pleasant sensation, like sliding into sleep. My death having happened, I was in a position to watch developments without feeling a thing, or, to put it more accurately, without feeling anything that was being done to my mortal remains, my corpse. When Harry got back from his tea break, he transferred the load of mixed concrete into a truck, and as my remains were by then well mixed with the concrete, they were transferred to the truck too. The truck drove off to a building site in central Manchester, and there the load of concrete, and my corpse, was poured straight into a mold for a stanchion that was to be used as one of the main supports of the building. And there my remains remain, cased in concrete, 50 feet above ground, and now quite solid. As one of my less tasteful companions here put it, a rather stiff. I did not reward his unseemly remark with even the ghost of a smile. Being sealed in a pillar of concrete, however, is the cause of the trouble I now found myself in, for unfortunately no one knows my earthly remains are there. No one, that is, who hasn't yet died. Worse still, no one knows I'm dead, which is why my spiritual being is trapped here in this ghostly condition. As far as I can gather, one of the reasons, among many, why people get stuck between life and afterlife is that their deaths are unknown to their earthbound relatives. I was very surprised, I might tell you, to discover how many people get caught in this state of being for all kinds of reasons. You expect to find murderers, of course, and there are plenty, though on the whole they turn out to be jolly nice blokes. But I was taken aback at the number of school teachers, for example, and politicians and army officers. The teachers and politicians spend most of their time trying to talk their way into the afterlife and never succeed. The army officers, however, take to this life very well. They enjoy going on what they call chill jaunts, the kind of haunting that makes earthbound people scream and turn pale. I need hardly add, they do this as badly as most of them did everything else in their earth life. Not that this matters much, for with its loss of popularity among earth people, ghostly haunting is rather a disappointing occupation these days. Everybody here is in very low spirits about it. But I'm rambling again. It's one of the hazards of being a ghost. You have so much time on your hands and very little to do with it. As I say, being caught in the in-between, ghostly life, a kind of limbo land between mortality and eternity, is a bit of a bore, and my aim is to pass on as quickly as possible. But to do this, my relatives must be informed of my death. And as they are not likely to discover my remains in their present secure location, the chances of my parents discovering my death are pretty slim. So I decided I must somehow or other get a message to them. You have no idea how difficult it is to get a simple message from the dead to the living. The living just won't listen, and this present climate of disbelief in the afterlife only makes the task more difficult. I asked some of the older ghosts around here for advice. Everyone told me the same thing. Don't bother. It would be a waste of time and energy, they said, and I'd only end up getting the jitters. I know now what they meant. Talking to people who pretend you aren't there is worse than being banished. At least when people send you away, they don't pretend you aren't there. They just ignore you. However, being a newcomer to the ghostly life, I refused to listen to such good advice. They were all old codgers, I told myself, spirits whose energies were worn out, sapped by years of failure. They had stopped trying. Giving up the ghost seemed hardly the right expression under the circumstances. What was wanted was a little enterprise, a little originality, and most of all, some determination. I believed I possessed all three in quantity. My older companion smiled tolerantly, as wise old men always do when confronted with youthful foolishness, and drifted away to enjoy themselves at their leisure. So, heedless to good counsel, I set to work. Two factors led to my first method of attempting to get in touch. First, though I want to communicate with my relatives, I did not want to upset them by suddenly materializing unannounced in the front room at home while they were watching television. They might have joined me in my present state, dispatched here by shock. Dad, after all, has a weak heart, and Mom has always been of a nervous disposition. I did think of contacting my girlfriend Veronica, who, in a way, was responsible for the situation I am now in. But she had already taken up with another fellow, and the one thing that was clear to me even then was that it was useless trying to make contact with mortals who have lost all interest in you, as well as having no belief in ghosts anyway. Veronica has certainly lost interest in me within a couple of days of my disappearance, as I knew from what I had observed of her evenings out with her new boyfriend, the one who was causing the trouble that started me thinking, that led to me slipping into the concrete mixer. As for ghosts, Veronica went all through the film of Nightmare House without a twinge of fear, while it scared me for weeks. So Veronica was out. The second thing that decided me on my first course of action was that, being a novice at materialization and ghostly activities in general, it was easier to appear at the place of my death than anywhere else. That meant a haunting of the mixing yard at work. Fine, I thought, just right. I'll do my stuff in front of Harry, and I'll appear looking just as I did on the fatal day, dressed in my overalls. He'd be sure to recognize me then and be less likely to get the willies, thinking he is seeing any old ghost. With the confidence that ignorance inspires in men, I went through the materialization routine and successfully took my former shape 3 feet from Harry at 4:30 on the afternoon of the Thursday following the day I died. It was a beautiful day. The sun shining from a blue sky as it sank toward the spring evening. Harry was tending the mixer stripped down to his vest. He was so warm. I stood there in front of him for a full minute and more, waiting for him to catch sight of me. I nodded and smiled in a friendly way so that he would know I wasn't a malevolent type. We had, after all, had our arguments from time to time. He kept glancing at me, but showed not a flicker of reaction. At first, this didn't bother me. He's a slow-witted lad. But then I started to lose patience. I waved at him, danced about a bit, even took a step nearer to him. He would have to be blind not to see me now, I thought. Then I heard a cough at my elbow. I dematerialized to find an old ghost by the name of Cathcart Fitzgammon standing by my side. He was tut-tutting in a haughty manner and shaking the gray-haired locks he insists on keeping so as to retain his 18th-century look. "Dash it, young fellow," he said. "You'll do no good like that." I felt a bit bad-tempered that he had interrupted my very first haunt in such a way. "Why not?" I snapped. "Daylight haunts need considerable skill and experience, old chap," he said. "Besides, which you were standing with the setting sun right behind you. That poor mortal, whose attention you hoped to attract, would never have seen you no matter how bright you managed to make your appearance." "You haven't a hope in, on earth of catching his eye. If I were you, I'd have a go during the night. It's easier then." He drifted off without another word, chuckling to himself. Of course, I had to admit that Cathcart was right. He had also put me off my stroke, and I needed time to collect myself again. So I postponed operations for an hour or two while I considered the situation. The difficulty was that if I appeared in daylight, Harry would probably not see me. But if I waited until dark, or dusk even, Harry would have gone home, so that there would be no one to communicate with anyhow, and I'd be left shivering and alone in the cold. As far as I could see, there was only one solution. I found Harry's car in the works parking lot, dissolved inside and made myself comfortable on the back seat, intending to wait until Harry knocked off work and went home. Then, When he went out for the evening, I'd materialize on the passenger seat beside him at a convenient moment and tell him my news. That way, I'd know where Harry was when darkness fell, saving myself arms of energy flying about looking for him. Parking lots are dismal places, as much for ghosts as mortals, which is why you rarely hear of hauntings in them. And there was no one about of my kind to pass the time of day with, so very soon I was bored. And what with the bright sun and the stuffy warmth of Harry's car, I very soon dozed off. There's nothing like bright light and warmth for setting a ghost nodding. Half an hour after dissolving into Harry's car, I was as dormant as a flat battery. I came to hours later. Night had fallen and was encouragingly black without the stars or moon. It was so black, I thought at first the car must be parked in Harry's garage. But then I heard a noise from the front seat that indicated very clearly that we weren't in Harry's garage at all. I looked up and there was Harry necking with his girlfriend, a shapely lass from the accounts office at work. We were parked under some trees in a picnic area just out of town. Naturally, I felt a little uncomfortable, but I'm not one of those ghosts who go around peeping at friends they've left behind, enjoying the sight of them in all kinds of situations, both public and private. Personally, I think that's as sick an occupation for a ghost as it is for a mortal. But I'd spent a good deal of time and energy already keeping up with Harry so that I could get my message to him, and I wasn't going to give in now. I had to act quickly before things got really embarrassing. Without another thought, I went through the drill for materialization at double quick pace. Unfortunately, in my haste, I put too much energy into some parts of the drill and not enough into others, and was rather careless overall. My lack of experience as a haunter, you see, the result was astonishing and, but for the circumstances, might have been both interesting and amusing. The materialization got completely out of control. Instead of appearing as myself in a gentle glow of unearthly light, I came out as a collection of very violent phosphorescent colors, revealing a hideous object with an enormous head, twisted features, a bloated body, and unfinished stunted arms and legs. I did not realize at first how I looked, for of course my attention was fully directed at Harry's back so that I should be ready to speak soothing words as soon as he turned around. So, thinking all was well, I coughed politely to attract his attention. But the cough also came out quite unlike what I intended. Instead of a soft hacking noise, I heard myself produce what I can only describe as a torrent of prolonged and vicious snarls. At once, I knew that something was wrong. Took a glance at myself, immediately felt angry with myself for being so careless, which only made matters worse, for my annoyance was transmitted into the materialization and imprinted itself on the warped feature of the ghostly figure I had projected, turning an already ghastly face into something so horrible that I almost fainted at the sight of it. The blaze of phosphor colors, the appearance of my misshapen ghost, the imprinting of my anger on its features, all happened in the blinking of an eye. But it was enough to attract Harry's and his girl's attention. They unraveled themselves with incredible speed, swung around on their seats, and came face to face with my apparition, just as the snarls that were meant to be a cough broke the silence of the night. For a split second, they stared in wide-eyed disbelief at the appalling creature hovering in the air above the back seat. Stunned shock was replaced by nerve-shattered fear. The blood drained from their faces, their mouths dropped open. Then each one let out a hysterical scream. This brought me to my senses. I dematerialized with such speed that the warped and shining figure I had created, instead of fading away, exploded like a searchlight bulb fusing from a short circuit. The car was plunged into a blackness that seemed by contrast with the brief brilliance of my ghostly glow to be tangible. I had no time to think how I might remedy my awful error. Harry's girl flung open the car door and ran in blind terror, screaming into the night. Harry was only a heartbeat behind. They left me exhausted on the back seat. It took me an hour to collect my thoughts and reorganize my energy, after which I felt so disappointed I trailed off home to my concrete pillar and stayed there for 2 days, suffering from acute depression. Ghost friends told me I should have been more than pleased with myself. They pointed out in their efforts to cheer me up that in these days of disbelief in ghosts, I should be proud of my success in scaring two mortals out of their wits. But I'm afraid I couldn't see it like that. I had made a hash of the thing I really wanted to do, and I had been professionally careless. There was no excuse for such things. And as a result, I was paying the price. I was still slopping around in ghostly limbo. Not that it is a bad life, as lives go, but it is not the ultimate, not the life any sane soul desires. And when you are within range of that life, as I am now that I am dead, the desire becomes a yearning almost painfully strong. The wise old man who said that hell is a yearning to be in heaven was right after all. But I cannot satisfy that yearning until I can persuade some mortal that I am dead, that my earthly remains are safely stowed away among the steel girders and concrete pillars of the Sure Shield Insurance Building, Manchester. 2 days' rest worked wonders. I got over my depression, recharged myself, did a good deal of thinking. The third day I spent discussing my new ideas with the most experienced ghost who lived within convenient range of my quarters in the pillar. The consensus of opinion was that I had two possible courses of action open to me. Neither was easy to pull off successfully. I chose spirit possession first. To get the best results from spirit possession, you need an emotionally unstable mortal with a vivid imagination and a mind open to suggestion. All the experts told me that teenage girls are admirable for the purpose, and I knew just the right one for me. My sister. Angela is 16. She is emotionally so unstable that she is as happy as a lark one minute and sweeping like a sick willow the next. Her imagination is vivid to the point of being lurid. At any rate, it allows her to see pimply teenage boys as Greek gods, which anyone has to admit takes a powerful imagination. As for her mind, it is as pliant as warm putty. On the other hand, like most girls of her age, her constitution is as tough as tempered steel, so I had no fears of any ill effects on her health if my still rather amateur ghosting went badly wrong, as it had done with Harry. Harry, by the way, recovered his car the next day in broad daylight, after which he had the local vicar exorcise it, something I regard as extravagant cheek, seeing he never goes near a church from 1 year's end to the next. Angela would do nicely. She also had the added advantage of being one of the family. She would know who and what I was talking about without tiresome and lengthy explanations. The only trouble with that possession is that it takes a day or two to get going properly. Had I appreciated before I began how much hard work goes into it on the ghost part, I'd certainly have dropped the entire idea at once. As it was, I went ahead with enthusiasm. I gave the first night up to dream-making. Well, before Angela's normal bedtime, I settled myself in her room and began to compose myself for the task ahead, inventing the dreams I'd put into Angela's head once I got inside her. A tricky business in itself. When her bedtime came, I was fully in the spirit of the occasion. Angela's bedtime came, but Angela did not. She did not even arrive home from an evening out until 12:30. By then, my concentration was already a bit frayed. Instead of feeling calm, collected, and spiritually prepared, I was irritable, out of joint, and sparking all over the place with nasty thoughts about my sister. I recalled ruefully that this was exactly the effect Angela had usually had on me during our earthly life together. When at last she arrived home, Dad was waiting to haul her over the coals for being out so late without permission. They argued. Angela flounced up to her room. By this time, she was in no condition for me or anyone else to possess her in any way at all. After slamming her door, she crashed around her room for a quarter of an hour, giving vent to her temper. Then for 10 minutes, she wept soulfully on her bed, just loudly enough for the parents to hear her, but not so loud that either of them would come in and console her. Finally, she pulled off her clothes, threw them in a heap on the floor, and fell bad-tempered into bed, where she lay awake for ages inventing the most lurid and morbid fantasies I have yet encountered in anyone's mind. Fantasies involving Dad, her boyfriend, who had kept her out late, and herself, in dramatic, romantic, and needless to add, tragic situations. I could hardly summon up enough brotherly affection and tenderness to go on with my plan. Indeed, for a while I was sorely tempted to give her the most blood-curdling and spine-chilling haunt I could manage, just to teach her a lesson. But eventually she drifted off to sleep, and I pulled myself together and went to work. You'll appreciate that at this point I must leave out technical details. The method by which one gets inside another person to control their thoughts is difficult enough to explain to a spirit. It is almost impossible to do so to a mortal. But should a mortal by some chance understand the explanation, then they would possess information that would give them a power over others of an extraordinary kind. If this power fell into the wrong hands, you can see what evil could be let loose in the world. All I can say is that for a couple of hours, I gave Angela the treatment. I started out with pleasant memory dreams. I used one about the two of us years ago when she was still very small and I saved her from drowning in a seaside pool all of 6 inches deep. At least I told Mama I had saved her, and Angela was only too glad to take part in the deception because it sounded like such a dramatic story and she was the center of it. I used the one about the Christmas when she was 13 and I gave her the first pair of nylons she had ever owned along with a gigantic box of Swiss chocolates. A rather spiteful gift, actually. She was trying to slim at the time, just at the puppy fat age. Then I brought back the time when I stood up for her against Mom and Dad. Angela wanted to stay out late at a party for the first time in her life. This seemed an appropriate memory to recall, considering the events of the night. There was lots more of this kind of thing before I decided she had had enough. I juggled everything about, of course, and exaggerated bits here, suppressed unpleasant details there, and generally colored the dreams up so that everything was larger than life. A real potpourri of a dream, it was. By the time I was finished, Angela was in a very receptive mood indeed, whimpering with nostalgia for the happy times we'd had together. In fact, we were always bickering and backbiting, but time and dreams, and death most of all, are powerful antidotes to people's recollections of the truth, as you'll have noticed, I expect. This done, I was ready to start on the big scene. A surrealist nightmare that Salvador Dali would have been proud to invent. Angela saw me in every deadly situation imaginable. I fell from a cliff into swirling angry waves over which the sun shone, but a sun that looked like a huge illuminated clock with the hands showing 3:30, the time at which I slipped into the mixer. I pictured her stirring a pan of porridge. She hates porridge. She saw an insect threshing about in the pan, looked closer, saw it was not an insect, but me. At that moment, I disappeared under the surface and the oven clock rang its alarm bell with the hands pointing to 3 and 6. On and on until Angela was in a sweat of anxiety and was beginning to suspect what I wanted her to, that I was dead and not just missing. In the end, she was moaning and shaking her head in her sleep as if saying, "No, no." All this took a vast amount of energy, and I was soon dangerously tired. I decided that, before things got out of control, I should get some rest and observe the outcome of my first night's work. But, just to make sure that Angela did not dismiss her dreams when she woke up, I waited until the morning light brought her back to consciousness. Then, as soon as she opened her eyes, I picked up a bottle of cold cream from her dressing table and hurled it across the room. That did it. Angela was out of bed and into Mum's room without a second thought. There she poured out her confused dreams, confusing them all the more by trying to recount them to someone else. Mum thought Angela was ill. Dad, as always, listened calmly and said nothing. Angela insisted that her dreams were an omen, that I had not gone off somewhere secretly, as everyone said, but that I had died somehow, and not very pleasantly. Mum burst into tears and told Angela not to talk like that. "Where there's life, there's hope," she said. Angela then burst into tears too, said no one ever had understood her but me, that she knew, just knew, her dreams meant that I was dead, and that she felt like running away and never coming back. Dad sighed deeply and got up, saying he felt like a nice cup of tea. After this, Angela stormed from the room, dressed hurriedly, and left for school without eating any breakfast or saying another word. I had the uneasy feeling that my attempt to get a message to my family via Angela was doomed to failure. But I pressed on. The next night, I repeated the dreams, but this time I ended them by engraving a mental picture of myself in a tragic pose deep in Angela's mind before throwing a few things around the room in best poltergeist fashion just as she woke up. Once again, Angela ran to Mum. She was so desperately convincing and distressed that Mum took her seriously, listening sympathetically to her story. Mum even came into Angela's room to see the mess I'd made. Dad went off at the first sign of trouble to make himself a cup of tea. Angela, placated by Mom's sympathy and excited by the effect of her performance, she loves to be the central figure in a drama, set off for school in high spirits and there recounted her tale to all and sundry, though only after swearing each person to secrecy and telling them it was all in the strictest confidence. All that day I sat quietly smiling to myself. Here was progress after all. Another night and I could reveal myself and the details of my death and departure. The third night was much the same as the other two, with the addition of a ghostly and audible voice whispering, "Angela! Angela!" before my sister dropped off to sleep, and a bout of sleepwalking before I dispossessed her in the morning. I had every hope of complete success. My hopes were soon dashed. Angela woke pale, fatigued, and dizzy. I had overdone things. Mom took one look at the limp figure in the bed and sent for a doctor. There was, of course, nothing seriously the matter with the girl. True, she was tired and running a temperature, but all she needed was a day's rest. The situation now got out of control. The doctor was suspicious, though he pretended otherwise to Angela. He prescribed a tranquilizer and told her to stay in bed. But downstairs, he told Mom to keep an eye on that girl and report any change in her condition. Mom was only too delighted to have an opportunity of mothering her only daughter, and watched her every minute of the day, as much as she could manage of the following night. Dad drank endless cups of tea. Unimportant though these things may appear, they put me in a swivel. The tranquilizers made my task 3 times more difficult than before. My experience as a ghost was too limited to cope with the powers of modern medical science. Mum, on the other watch, meant that if I tried a haunt, she would be sure to see the effects, which would upset her more than I could bear. As for Dad's endless tea drinking, I recognized this as a sure sign that things were getting on top of him, and I had even less desire to upset him than I had to upset Mum. If he started worrying, the strain might affect his weak heart, and for all I knew, he'd end up joining me. This was a responsibility I dared not take. For a day or two, I let things ride, hoping Angela's health would improve when I could start work again. But during the doctor's last visit, Mum had a long private chat with him, telling him all about Angela's dreams and about the things being thrown around her room. The doctor said that he thought as much. He'd known at once that something was up. It was, he said, a common ailment among girls of Angela's age. The best thing would be to take Angela to a psychiatrist. I dropped my plans like a hot brick then and there and fled back to my pillar in the insurance building. Psychiatrists were the last people I wanted to tangle with, or to tangle with my sister. They can make haunting so complicated and mess one about so much that it just isn't worth the effort. It doesn't surprise me one bit that this ghostly limbo land is teeming with psychiatrists. More of them get stuck here than of any profession, and I've never heard of one of them getting through to the other side. Old Freud mopes around, muttering about sex, and Jung is always arguing with him and seeing archetypal patterns in the least likely places and events. They're a hopeless bunch. Well, my defeat at Mum's hands left me one more solution worth trying. Automatic writing. If this failed, then I was condemned to a desultory life in this ghostly state for years, maybe centuries, until someone accidentally found my remains in the insurance building. Luckily, modern buildings are made to last no more than a few years, so my prospects of being discovered were brighter than those of ghosts whose bodies are buried in ancient buildings that were built to last forever. I consulted the experts once more. Having recovered their cool after the shock of hearing any ghost as inexperienced as myself announce that he was taking up automatic writing, something only the most advanced and knowledgeable haunters ever even contemplate, they gave me a lot of useful tips. They warned me, for instance, not to employ professional mediums and clairvoyants. Professionals, they said, are usually phony anyway and have never made contact with anything more than their instinct for making money at the expense of the credulous. And those who are genuine spirit contacts, born with the power to speak the word spirit people put into their minds, are just like all actors. They love to add and take away from the original script. Never satisfied to let the spirit work through them, they can't resist adding a touch of detail there and missing the main point here, while they have an insatiable taste for melodrama, for dressing up in weird clothes and rigging outlandish gimmicks, and upstaging any poor spirit who is foolish enough to get involved with them. No, my advisor said, they are an odd lot and best left alone. What you must do, they told me, is find an ordinary person who is clairvoyant and doesn't know it. They are the people most likely to have the special makeup of personality you need to work through, while they won't try to take part themselves in writing your message. I spent 5 weeks looking around for suitable mortals, ones with the right qualities for such difficult work as I had in mind. People pure in spirit, innocent in nature, neither naive nor overwise. Above all, they must possess great faith. Faith in life as worth living despite its horrors and troubles. Faith in human nature and the durability of that incomparably beautiful but elusive creation, the human soul. Such people, I discovered, are rare indeed. But I found one in the end, though with a little thought I might have realized where to look and search here first. I came to this old people's home on the edge of town only this evening. A deaf old man lives here, and has done so for the last 20 years since his wife died. He has 2 sons, both big men in business these days and very busy. Too busy ever to come and see the old man. He has a daughter, too, but she has her own family to cope with and manages to visit only on special occasions like Christmas and her father's birthday. So he passes his days alone, reading and thinking and watching the world go by in the silence of his being. For 40 years, he worked day in, day out as a joiner. He loved his garden, brought his family up as tenderly as he cared for his tomatoes and sweet peas. From his early 20s, the pride and joy of his life was his beloved wife, and she doted on him as much as he on her, though she sometimes pretended otherwise. Now she is gone. He is too old to garden, his children grown up and scattered. At first, after his wife's death, he grieved bitterly, but he conquered his grief, and every day that passes his faith deepens in the world to come. This is the man who now writes his message for me. My hope is that when he wakes and finds his hastily scribbled pages by his bedside, the pencil still clutched in his gnarled old hand, he will do me one further act of kindness, like the many others which have passed unnoticed in his life, and convey my news to my family. Or, perhaps not, I begin to see that this old saint has something to teach me, who should be beyond teaching. Perhaps, old man, it is best that my sudden end and my curious whereabouts remain unknown. Perhaps I need time to dwell as much as you have done on the nature of life and death. Perhaps, when I have done this and plumbed the depths of that knowledge, I will be ready to pass from the staging post of death into the life eternal, as ready as you are now to pass from mortality into immortality without a stopping place between. Quite a thought. Perhaps, after all, I am in this limbo land for a purpose I had not understood till now. I'm grateful to you, old man, but I will leave this message by your side for your eyes only, to see It can be a sign to you that you have not lived in vain. After reading it, do with it as you please. Peace. Note: these papers were by the bedside of Mr. James Harry Gibbons on the morning he was found dead, aged 78. I suppose they are the ramblings of a dying man's imagination. Signed, A. C. Harris Warden, The Hermitage.